This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
During the presidential election season, there was a lot of talk about illegal aliens. Well, get ready. We're about to talk about aliens again, but the other kind, the ones from outer space.
And if you only count things that are like us, well, A, that's a bit of a blind alley, and B, it's scientifically indefensible.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, our astrobiology series returns with a look at the search for extraterrestrial life and what finding it might mean for our society. Then we'll spend an academic minute taking a look at a very different kind of alien species, one that is already having consequences right here on Earth. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Our astrobiology series can sometimes go off topic, but this time around we're really dealing with astrobiology. And by that, we mean aliens. If we were to discover extraterrestrial life, would it be friendly or hostile? What would it look like? And even more interestingly, would our own human conception of aliens bias the science of discovering, studying, and interacting with them? Enter Dr. Catherine Denning, an archaeologist, anthropologist, and associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at York University. Dr. Denning is on the forefront of the evolving field of astrobiology, and she tells the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter, David Gustina, that we have entered a new era in the search for extraterrestrial life.
Well, my basic argument was that we're entering a new era for astrobiology. Of course, the field isn't very old. It's only, either 10 years or 50 years old, depending on how you look at it. And just this question about how did life begin? Where else might it be? Does it exist elsewhere in the universe? All of these different questions, they always take place in real time and in real social space. And as those conditions move, then the science has to move with it. So, of course, there's been a great scientific progress on every aspect of that question about how life originated, evolved, and whether what the potentials might be for it elsewhere, potential environments. But what I think astrobiologists need to know about now is how all the conditions for the science are moving. So one of the main things to think about is the way that the human presence in the solar system is about to change hugely. This is unprecedented. Until now, the people with the access to the solar system have, of course, been scientists, and that's been through NASA and through the European Space Agency, etc. But that's about to really go wild with private space exploration. And this means that for the first time, people who want to do science out there in the solar system are going to have to negotiate. And they're going to have to negotiate hard, and they're going to have to negotiate fast. Because one thing I can tell you from my background as an anthropologist and as an archaeologist, those are fields where the subjects of our study have been continually under siege. If there's anything you want to protect, you're already late.
There's a big, big overarching question here, which is sort of how come, and also how does an archaeologist and an anthropologist get involved with something called SETI, or the search for extraterrestrial life?
Yes, and it's all Carl Sagan's fault in more ways than one. It is actually true, because I saw Cosmos as a kid, and it's quite funny because I can literally tell you that I came to archaeology because of Carl Sagan. When you think about it, I don't know when the last time you watched that series was, but he was talking about ancient science. He was talking about the decipherment of hieroglyphs. And so I actually met Egyptology and ancient Egypt through Carl Sagan. So it was always through within this kind of huge, sweeping context of how everything evolved, starting with the universe and then moving to culture and then how our understanding of the universe evolved. And so that really was a very important intellectual framework for me at a pretty tender age. And from then, well, I went on and went off to university. I was always doing both arts and sciences simultaneously, and then the die was kind of cast in my first year because my archaeology professor was better than my biology professor. And so it goes. But what I was interested in was always the big evolutionary questions. I was interested in them for people, but then became interested in, well, how does science work? And this area of astrobiology, which is working from what we do know, trying so hard to study what we don't, that's actually a lot like what we do in archaeology, because we have these fragments, and yet we're never going to be able to really reassemble the past, but what matters is what we do with the spaces.
And let me ask you this, because let's take an ancient civilization like the Egyptians. Mm. And when we're doing that anthropological research and the archaeology of uncovering these things, it's a partial. You are undoubtedly looking for patterns, trying to understand what those patterns mean from reference points, and then extrapolating that information to come to some conclusions about that ancient civilization. So I can see immediately, Dr. Denning, where this would have applications in the search for extraterrestrial life, because it's a civilization we're trying to find, right, and understand.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's kind of a double application there. So one is no evidence of anything out there at all yet, right? So it's all space, which means that it's all projection. And what we do is we project typically our ideas about what a civilization is and how it works and how it evolves and where it goes. We just project that out into space and then expect it to come back to us in the form of aliens, which is kind of doubly interesting and doubly funny, really, for an archaeologist. And one of the reasons why is that our popular constructions of alien civilizations, the idea that they would, you know, come in great big spaceships and land on the White House lawn, these kinds of things, those are just, they're purely all about us, right? And when you think, for example, about how War of the Worlds started, that was part of invasion literature, which was a genre at the time. It wasn't about aliens, it was about us. And that's what so much of this actually really is about. And so when people have hopes for benign aliens that know everything, or when they have fears of hostile aliens that are going to come and obliterate the Earth, well, what are we really talking about there? It's pretty transparent, but it is fascinating from the anthropological perspective.
You have talked about, in some of the research that I've been looking at, the third era. And I assume that you're talking about what you began with, which is this idea of private exploration of space, not the sole venue of scientists, and therefore a certain amount of competition. And as you've just been saying, you know, we go out there with our own preconceived notions and see if they'll fit those models. So I can already hear some of the hard-nosed scientists saying, you people in the social sciences, we do observation and it's based on fact and we repeat those observations and therefore we can come down to almost 100% understanding of things. And you say?
Well, it depends on exactly what we're talking about. My position is that, I mean, scientists create incredibly important understandings of specific bodies of information, but then those things go wild in the world. They don't contain what they mean to people. And that's where you do need the social scientists, and that's where you do need the scholars of humanity to understand what the science does in the world, but also what the world does to the science, where it allows it to exist, where it encourages it to exist, and where it will sabotage it for other reasons.
So you could even throw in something like political reasons for why certain studies, the government funds certain scientific ventures and studies, right? That's a human interaction.
Oh, well, and in the world of space, I don't think it's exactly mind-blowing to observe that the exploration of space and the study of space has always been intertwined with political objectives. So there is science, and it matters, but it's never only science, and it's never all about the science.
Let's get even simpler, because you gave a great example in something that I read about time and about how there were certain elements of time, like a day, for example, that could be found in reality. The Earth spins around on its axis in a day. You could even make that argument for a month. But really, there are social constructions, ultimately, when we think of something like time.
I think the example you're referring to there was my effort to do something with the Maya 2012 kerfuffle, which is proceeding apace. Yes, it's the bane of astronomers and archaeologists alike. The bane of astronomers because it's talking about things that don't happen, and it's the bane of archaeologists because it's talking about things that the Maya never said. So it's eight different kinds of wrong.
And this will be very interesting to some of our lay listeners. I'm sure those of us with a doomsday mentality have already paid attention to, is the end of the world coming in 2012, this year in December. But your article very clearly points out this very area where I want you to go.
Well, so as for the social construction of time, how do we understand our place in time and perhaps even our place in evolution and our place in the universe? It has these points of reality, these points of data. So, I mean, the Earth does go around the sun and it does wobble on its axis, and those numbers are real and they are observable. But there's so much else that we make up, that we construct. So we construct the week. It has no reality. I mean, a year is real, a day is real, a month is more or less real, but a decade is not real, a century isn't real. These are things are made up, and yet we live within them, and we panic on a Saturday night because Sunday morning might not come. Well, that's not true. We celebrate on the Saturday night, but this millennial panic, this idea that, you know, we're coming to the end of an era, and that means something, that there might not be another one, that's a very strange and completely culturally constructed phenomenon.
And it is these socially constructed cultural phenomenon with your understandings that is helping you to assist scientists in understanding, well, in the search for extraterrestrial life, what will we be looking for and how is that affected by our own constructions? And then what might be a better way to think about or go about understanding what's out there, let's say? Am I on to that? Am I right on that?
Yeah, I would say that you are. One of the hardest things in archaeology is learning to look only at what's there and stripping away your preconceptions, because the past was different. People did different things there. I mean, they were human in all the same physical ways that we are, and they had the same fundamental human realities. They needed to eat and sleep and have families and all of those things. But they did it differently, and it meant different things to them. And so if we look at these fragments from the past and we project our present understandings on them, we're lost. So that's one thing archaeologists are very good at, is separating out what we know from what we're assuming. And that kind of knowledge does transfer then to this question of what might be out there, because it helps us to separate what we really do know, which is fragments of things from Earth, from what we really don't, which is how those things go together and how generalizable they might be. And you can, if you're from a field that really likes the big, bold generalizations and likes the mathematical models, you can create those models, but you have to be very aware of what they do and don't mean. And in the absence of tests, when we don't actually have anything to test those models against yet, that's a real challenge, and that's part of what the anthropological perspective is for.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Catherine Denning on the possibility of aliens continues. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1159. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Catherine Denning, an archaeologist, anthropologist, and associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at York University. She's speaking with The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter, David Gustina, as part of our astrobiology series about the possibility of there being life on other planets.
In talking to some of the other scientists that we've had here in our Origins of Life series, one of them in particular was responsible for finding exoplanets outside of our solar system. And in his search for life on these exoplanets, it became very clear that there were conditions, quote, conditions for life that didn't look like anything you would see on most of the Earth, although at the bottom of some oceans and some other very inhospitable places on the planet, we do have similar conditions where we're now finding life exists. So to your point here, that any preconceived notion, once we get out into space, has to sort of be pushed aside, and this ability to, I guess is no way to be objective, but your observation has to be as clear as possible to see it for what it is.
Well, part of the question is, how can we really be ready for the alien? How can we really see what we can't yet imagine? And how can we just be open to all the possibilities? And that work really does start at home. And this is one of the reasons for one of the other projects that I do. So I work on astrobiology and society. I work on SETI, but I also work on intelligence. And that has been a really interesting project that I'm working on with my colleague, Lori Marino, from Emory University. So she's a neurobiologist who specializes in dolphins and in whales and in the evolution of their brains. And why we joined forces was to try and shake up how people think about intelligence, because it comes partly down to this question of, well, how prevalent might it be in the universe? Now, that's a wide open question, because first of all, you need life. But anyway, if you start from the assumption that, yes, life probably has arisen elsewhere, then the next question is, well, how much of it does evolve to complexity beyond the microbial level? How much of it might become intelligent? But then you need to start asking really hard questions about what counts as intelligence? What matters? And if you only count things that are like us, well, A, that's a bit of a blind alley, and B, it's scientifically indefensible, because we look around at this world here, and there are so many different forms of intelligence here on Earth, and they all matter in their own ways, not just because of sentient beings with, you know, that should be cared for, but because the science matters. And this is a very important thing, because we have been so slow to recognize the intelligence that is all around us. And that's been the work of primatology, and that's been the work of cetacean behavioral studies and so many other kinds of ethology of the last several decades, has been understanding, whoa, look at what everything that these beings can do, and how did they evolve to do that?
I imagine you might be discovering a bias when it comes to humans and their thought of their own intelligence.
More than a little.
I also understand that part of the intelligent life on Earth involves students. And in your class, anticipating the alien, I imagine you're getting into some of this. Can you tell us more about the course?
Sure, yeah. That's a graduate course that I've had the great pleasure of teaching within the Science and Technology Studies program at York this year. So unleashing some very fine graduate student minds from biology, from physics, from history, from all different areas on this subject of astrobiology and the search for life in the universe. The course itself, what we do is we start with the beginnings of astrobiology, and then we just take it forward to the present day and into the future.
I mentioned to you before we came in here that we see a little bit of a clue, as you often point out in some of these articles, about the sort of popularized cultural doomsday movies. Often our negotiating tactic seems to be to send a missile in the direction of the perceived threat. And we just recently were greeted to a more serious article from scientists. In fact, I think it was Stephen Hawking who suggested that if we did discover alien life, that perhaps it would be more likely that they would be coming after us for some resource and be a threat rather than be a friend, as in take me to your leader. Maybe some preconceived notions there? What do you think?
I wish our listeners could see the pained smile upon my face. It's two reasons. One, Stephen Hawking is a brilliant physicist. What he tends to do when he talks about these possibilities for extraterrestrial life is refract it back through the experiences of contact here on Earth. So what he'll say, for example, is, well, it might be dangerous to transmit or to seek signals and to attempt to make contact with aliens because, well, if you look at what happened when Columbus came to the Americas, that didn't turn out very well for the Native Americans, did it? And that's a fair observation in that, no, it didn't really turn out all that well. But the problem is this inference about why. Because the popular idea is that the New World was devastated by the Old because the societies of the Old World were superior, and that that was kind of the inevitable trajectory of history. And his inference there, the illusion that he's drawing, suggests that, well, aliens would be more advanced and just more aggressive and just a superior civilization, and therefore we would get our butts kicked. But you know, that's not how it worked. It was epidemic disease that devastated the New World repeatedly, just beyond modern imagining. And it's just not a fair analogy. And so when he makes remarks like that, the point may be valid. We don't know what aliens might be like. We actually really, really don't know. But to then drag human history into it in this kind of way, it does more than one kind of work. And I have a problem with that.
I could talk to you for a much longer time. Unfortunately, we're running out of time here. As you go forward in your research and you look into this new era, do you see a day? And do you think that we will make some sort of contact?
I have no idea about that. What I think about now instead, after you've spent a few years working around SETI and astrobiology, that question almost ceases to be meaningful. Because either it happens or it doesn't. And here's what you can do. You can keep doing the science. because otherwise you're not going to get your answer. And here's what you can do next, is you can think about how to keep the conditions open so you can keep doing the science. And this is where it starts to matter now, and this is why I am actually starting to lose patience with kind of speculation about, well, what might be. Because if we want those answers at all, we need to ensure that science has good access to the solar system to study things before they're hopelessly contaminated by other human objectives, because that's going to be the easiest place to find some of those answers. And we need to make sure that science will continue to have access to the airwaves in order to do the studies, in order to search the skies. So those are the things that I think now about much more than the what ifs. I think about the things that are happening around right now that jeopardize the science that could give us those answers.
Is there any move toward a message that's put out, again, rife with bias and perception here, but the idea of trying to come up with something that we think could be received?
Oh, there are lots of people working on that. There are quite a few different groups that work on message construction. The idea of, well, okay, not only what do you say, but how do you say it in a way that might be interpretable? And then there are people that have transmission projects going. It's an interesting question. First of all, it's an interesting question as to whether or not it's ethical to be actively transmitting. That's a huge debate, because some say...
How come?
Oh, because, again, because if the alien is completely unknown. It's possible, could be benign, could be hostile. We don't know, and we have no way of calculating those odds. And so there's a very real debate within the scientific community about whether or not it's safe and or ethical to transmit.
Well, I can assure you that we may not get an answer, but this broadcast will be emanating through space, and maybe someone will pick it up. You never know, right? You can't say yes, you can't say no, Dr. Denning.
You never know. Hello to everybody out there.
Dr. Catherine Denning is an archaeologist, anthropologist, and associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at York University. She spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter, David Gustina, as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life. Our coverage is made possible by the NASA Astrobiology Institute through support from the New York Center for Astrobiology, located at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, in partnership with the University of Albany, the University of Arizona, and Syracuse University. You can learn more about all of the topics on our astrobiology series at origins.rpi.edu. Dealing with an alien species doesn't have to mean talking to a tourist from outer space. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. As the speed at which we move goods around the planet has increased, so have the problems posed by invasive species. But as Richard Lankow, assistant professor of plant biology at the University of Georgia, explains, some native plants have started evolving to cope with the unwanted invaders.
Invasive species can devastate ecosystems, and it is often assumed that native species will not be able to mount a successful defense. Because native species have no history of coexisting with the invaders during their evolution, they never evolved countermeasures to combat the new species. Garlic mustard, a familiar invasive plant to many in the eastern U.S., provides a classic example of this phenomenon. Garlic mustard produces toxic chemicals that hurt native plants indirectly, by killing the beneficial soil fungi that the native plants use to acquire resources. Since these chemicals are new to North America, native plants had no defense against them when garlic mustard first arrived over 100 years ago. In my research, I wanted to determine whether any native plants have started to evolve resistance against this invader over that time. To do this, I compared populations of a common native plant, clearweed, that grew in areas that have yet to be invaded by garlic mustard, and in areas that have been invaded to various degrees. I found that native clearweed plants from an area that had never been invaded were most vulnerable to garlic mustard. However, native clearweed plants collected from areas where garlic mustard was present and producing high amounts of its toxic chemicals were more tolerant of the invader. They achieved this tolerance partly by reducing their dependence on the beneficial soil fungi that the invader kills. Despite our best efforts to remove them, invaders like garlic mustard are probably here to stay. So it is encouraging to find that native plants may be able to evolve to tolerate the invaders and eventually integrate them into their larger ecological community. Future research should consider how to promote this process and minimize the damage done while we wait for this evolution to occur.
That was Richard Lankow of the University of Georgia. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we've got for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.